From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up with key races for state House, state Senate, and governor, it's going to be a big election year in Pennsylvania. Stephen Caruso, Capitol reporter of Spotlight PA, joins me to break down the margins, the issues, and the battleground districts in this swingiest of swing states. Plus, after being defunded last year, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is voted to officially dissolve. I'll go over their statement with you. But before all that, before we dive deep into Harrisburg politics, let's get the latest news from Albany, where Governor Kathy Hochul is proposing additional measures aimed at keeping kids safe online. She says these measures will be part of her State of the State speech next week. Samuel King with the New York Public News Network reports.
Speaking at Hamburg High School, her alma mater, Governor Hochul lamented how much has changed for students since she graduated in 1975, including dangers online. Her new proposals would expand age verification requirements for platforms, including online gaming, and disable AI chatbots on social media platforms. They would also impose new restrictions on social media platforms to keep strangers from contacting kids.
To automatically default to those privacy settings at the highest levels for anyone under the age of 18. Think about that. Parents, you won't have to worry about it.
Last year, the state banned smartphones in school classrooms and required warning labels be added to social media sites. In Albany, I'm Samuel King for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you to Samuel King. Well, we've heard from Governor Hochul. Now let's hear from one of her opponents. Taxes on tips will be abolished up to a certain amount under a new proposal by Governor Kathy Hochul, who says that as part of her upcoming executive budget proposal, she would eliminate state tax on tipped income up to $25,000, and this would be to align with federal guidance. Republican candidate for New York Governor Bruce Blakeman pointed out that a Republican-backed bill to do just that already exists, but has been stuck in the state legislature for almost a year. Speaking in Tawanda yesterday, Blakeman said Hochul only proposed the idea once his campaign started talking about it.
I guess she thinks we're good leaders because she's following what we said, but she's doing too little too late. It should be done now. It should be done in 2026. Why should hardworking men and women have to wait so long, another year, pay taxes on their tips, when we could eliminate it right now? Senator Jack Martin's bill, which was a bill that the governor could have insisted be passed this last legislative session, which would have eliminated tips on taxes on tips. We want to eliminate taxes on tips because we've got all these people out there, they're working for a very small wage, and they depend on their tips to be able to pay for the necessities of life.
A representative from Governor Hochul's office said that this proposal on tips taxes is coming now because this is the first opportunity to do so since the federal government's elimination of taxes on tips was signed into law on July 4th. New York's legislative session ended before that in June and is only starting again this week. And that's the latest news from New York State.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Well, control of Pennsylvania state government is once again on the line with key races in the state House, state Senate, and governor unfolding this year. The 2026 election cycle is shaping up to be one of the most consequential in recent memory, potentially determining which party controls policy on everything from taxes and education to election law and energy. Recent analysis from Spotlight PA breaks down the battleground district, shifting political dynamics, and what early results are already signaling about November. Joining us now is a person who did a lot of that breaking down. It's Stephen Caruso, Capitol reporter for Spotlight PA. Stephen, welcome back to the Local Edition.
Thank you for having me, as always.
So can you explain why the 2026 elections are being called such a high-stakes moment for Pennsylvania's legislature, like in the sense of the overview?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it just comes down to our legislature is the one who passes the laws that, can be enacted on anything from, as you mentioned, from what is the tax rates, what is education policy, what's our election law going to be, what's our abortion laws, our gun laws, energy. And, right now we've had a split legislature for the past, it's going to be 4 years in November. The House is being controlled by Democrats. The Senate is being controlled by Republicans. They've struggled to compromise. There have been three straight late budgets, two of them particularly late. We're talking November, December. They're supposed to pass that by June 30th. Very few big issues have been tackled. I mean, you know, they've funded education and they've, you know, made sure that the trains keep running, barely. But, you know, things like property taxes, our election laws, many holes that have been exploited in lawsuits, the issues when it comes to energy prices have been broadly unaddressed by major policy initiatives. So the pieces on the chessboard, as one top state senator said, are dictated by the voters, and that's going to dictate what eventually gets done. That's all on the line of 2026. Voters are going to decide who controls each chamber. The House has a one-vote Democratic majority. The Senate has a four-vote Republican majority. But all that could change in these elections. And I should add, too, the governor is also up, you know, who signs the laws. Governor Josh Shapiro, he's been very popular. He just announced he's going to have $30 million cash on hand going into the year. So he's going to be a tough person to beat for Republicans, especially in a year that looks like will be pretty good for Democrats. But like all of these are pieces that could change depending on how voters go in 2026. And with divided government being so hard, if one party were to claim total control of government, it could open the door to some very vast changes to the Commonwealth that, you know, I think are even like almost hard to really, it's hard to overemphasize how big those changes could be.
What are the dynamics between Democrats and Republicans in the state House and Senate races right now?
Yeah, so, you know, like I said, Democrats have a one-vote majority in the House, 102 to 101. Republicans control the state Senate, 27 to 23. All seats of the House will be up for election. Only half the even-numbered seats will be up in the Senate. However, that's enough to swing either chamber. Well, I'll start with the state Senate, because Republicans have had a majority there almost uninterrupted since the 1980s. And that's a chamber that Democrats have constantly said, we're going to flip, we're going to flip, we're going to flip, and haven't. But again, you know, hope springs eternal. This is the year that Democrats say could be the year. That was aided by them flipping a seat in historically red Lancaster County in a March special election, which was a huge upset. It shocked Harrisburg, which got them to the 23. And all Democrats really need to do is pick up two seats. That means they can't lose anything now, and then pick up two seats, and then the chamber will be 25-25. And if Governor Josh Shapiro wins re-election, his lieutenant governor, Austin Davis, will come along with him. And that means Democrats control the agenda. And that could be big, because if you control the agenda, you control what comes up for a vote. They couldn't pass bills about Republicans, but there's plenty of Republicans who stake their reputation as moderates who'd still be sitting in that building, including a Republican from Philadelphia, from Erie, from suburban Pittsburgh, who might get sweaty if votes on the minimum wage, if votes on abortion come up, and what does that mean for them? So basically, getting two seats will give Democrats a huge upper hand because they'll control what comes up for a vote in the upper chamber. Then looking at the House, you know, Democrats have nursed this one-vote majority for 4 years. They even kept it in 2024, despite having a candidate running in a district that Trump won roughly 70-30. And that majority is they've passed a ton of far-reaching bills. They've passed transit funding, which is a big fight in Pennsylvania. They've passed bills to protect abortion access, like a constitutional amendment just last month. They passed stricter gun laws. They passed labor laws. They passed all sorts of things that usually get stalled in the Republican-controlled Senate. Now, Republicans are hoping they can maybe flip that chamber back. They held it for 12 years before the new maps brought this Democratic majority into being. But, you know, and there are going to be some members retiring. There's already one member from a very swingy district outside Pittsburgh who said she's not running again. Open seats are easier to flip. So I'm expecting a really rough and tumble back and forth with a lot of, you know, a lot of money being spent and some probably like pretty strong campaigns. But those will be all across the Commonwealth. We're talking from Pittsburgh to Coal Country to Scranton, the Poconos, all over the place. We'll probably see some really competitive races in the state House as, you know, Democrats hope to defend their majority and Republicans see if they can get back that one seat they need.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about those battleground districts, but just it sounds like you're laying out some pretty clear ambitions for both Democrats and Republicans. What if they're each able to flip one of the chambers and you still have a divided legislature just with a different party running each chamber?
I mean, I think it would scramble, you know, who kind of calls the biggest shots. Obviously, the chamber that has a majority probably has more leverage in budget talks. But, you know, I should be honest that, like, I think that what the Senate and the House even when there is total control of the legislature by one party, Republicans, they're different institutions. They don't always play nice with each other, even when the same party runs things. I'm sure there'd be some cosmetic changes, but on like what issues are focused on. I mean, you know, if depending on where the leader of that chamber is from, but you know, it'd probably leave us in a similar position of a standoff between the both parties. Like that would still be the top line takeaway. So yeah, I mean, that would be one of the funniest results, if I'm being honest. So we'll see if that happens. But it feels unlikely, but I feel like I've said things are unlikely that happen, and time makes fools of us all.
I mean, Pennsylvania does have a history of unpredictable elections.
Definitely. I mean, you know, I think it would probably take some really weird scandals or something that is really hard to predict for an outcome like that. You know, because Pennsylvania has unpredictable elections, but some of that's just because of like ticket splitting. It leads to things like, I would say like Josh Shapiro winning in 2016 for attorney general while Trump wins Pennsylvania, Trump winning while Democrats hold the state house, including like that member in that 70-30 district. Things usually happen in a way that's kind of makes sense. I struggle to think of like a scenario where enough people decide to vote out their Democratic state house members, but vote in their Senate Democrat. But like, again, it could happen. I think it's hard for me to imagine at this point of view right now.
To what extent are national issues, national politics impacting or may potentially impact what happens in the Commonwealth in 2026?
You know, all politics is local, but also national politics increasingly weighs on people's minds, I think, especially in this national media environment with polarization and whatnot. And those national politics kind of drive turnout. I mentioned earlier that half the reason Democrats feel optimistic about flipping the state Senate is they flip a seat in Lancaster County. That only happens because it was in March. It was one of Democrats' first opportunities to come out and vote against Republicans, against Trump, against Elon Musk and Doge, which is really active at the time. And they did it with gusto, and they flipped the seat. It also helps, I think, that the Republican there was unpopular. Again, there's always these local things that matter. But the top level of Democrats were more enthusiastic to go out and vote because they were so hopping mad is going to be a top level thing. And we saw that again in November of 2025 in our off-year statewide elections for Supreme Court. Democrats swept those despite a lot of money being spent, about $18 million and counting by my analysis. So, you know, I think that why that top level national politics matters is that it's going to motivate the average voter who maybe vaguely knows who their state rep is, maybe knows who the governor is. They probably know who the president is, and it's probably most likely that whatever's happening at the national level is going to dictate whether they go vote or don't. And I should say, historically in American politics, whichever party controls the presidency does poorly in a midterm. And that's usually particularly true for a second midterm, which is, would this, even though it wouldn't be, you know, consecutive terms, this is Trump's second midterm, President Trump's second midterm.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Stephen Caruso, Capitol reporter for Spotlight PA. Stephen, along those lines now, you mentioned the flipping that Lancaster County Senate seat. So I'm just wondering, let's talk a little bit about the battleground districts, what it looks like on the ground in the regional contests around the state. What are you looking at locally around the state?
I mean, it's fun because the Commonwealth is really varied. I think it's a pretty good slice of America in terms of big, diverse cities, more diversifying and wealthy suburbs, small cities, which, have a big immigrant populations, and then like farmland and deindustrializing towns. And just all of these represented Pennsylvania. And so all of these kind of become battlegrounds. In the state Senate, which is, I think going to attract a lot of attention, where you have some key seats in the Philadelphia suburbs, two Republican held seats there, I think, are top of Democrats' target list. You also have seats in the Lehigh Valley, an area that like is a mix of city, suburbs, and farmlands. I think that's an area that also does have two competitive seats. The Poconos, there's a Republican incumbent who I think just because that district at a national level is blue and blueing. The Poconos are also a region that, you're starting to get New York City expats who go into there, maybe super commute in. I think Democrats have some eyes on. And then out west, you're going to have, and then in Lancaster County, you have that one Democratic seat, which I think Republicans are going to try really hard to get back. I mean, the main question is, like, can they, in a year where Democratic turnout might be really good? And then out west, you're going to have seats where Democrats are going to have to defend themselves, in some of the suburbs that were held by Republicans as late as 2018, but they flipped. But, you know, a lot of suburbs have moved heavily blue. Again, that's kind of like the broad state of play. A lot of the competitive statehouse maps are, or districts are kind of underneath, would say, like, you know, are concurrent with a lot of those districts I mentioned, with a few exceptions, in some Western PA mill towns that still have a Democrat who's been holding out there for the whole Trump era. But, you know, there'd be a lot of overlap. And so, like, as a reporter, I'm going to probably, I'm crisscrossing the state to cover all these races, I'll be getting to see a slice of pretty much every part of America.
That just kind of reinforces, in my mind, the role that Pennsylvania's played in national politics. It's the bellwether of bellwether states, almost. I mean, it's what we're looking at when we look at big national elections, we look at presidential elections. Pennsylvania's been the keystone state in the center of the arch.
Well, you know, as a Pennsylvania political reporter, I probably should lean into that and say, absolutely, keep paying attention to my state. We're up there with all the other swing states. I think the main thing Pennsylvania is going for it is that it is the biggest prize in terms of electoral votes still. That could change. You know, demographics are constant. People constantly move. It makes it for some fascinating campaign season. Also infuriating, but, you know, that's a separate conversation.
Well, yeah, and that's politics and that's campaigning. Speaking of infuriating campaigns, let's talk about money in politics. Mentioned Governor Shapiro already touting pretty big war chest. What are you looking at in terms of money and within the state, but also outside donors influencing Pennsylvania races?
Yeah, so, Governor Josh Shapiro running for a second term. He was first elected in 2022. He already had entered 2025 with $11 million in the bank, which was more than our previous governor, Tom Wolf, had at the same point. And now he enters 2026 with $30 million. That is, by a quick analysis I was able to find, is at least triple what Wolf and other former governor, Democratic Governor Ed Rendell had. The Shapiro campaign's claiming it set a record, and I don't really have any grounds to dispute that. Record for a governor entering this. Shapiro has always been a strong fundraiser. The 2022 race set records, even most of it because of Shapiro. He's shown connections to big national donors in Silicon Valley and the tech industry in California, also folks in D.C., in Hollywood, in New York, all over the place. When you look through his campaign finance reports, it's almost a rogues gallery of, like, big Democratic institutional donors, the Soroses, whatnot. Also, obviously, a lot of the interest groups, unions, trial lawyers, Planned Parenthood, et cetera. All of them really flock to Shapiro. You know, part of that's, I think, you know, he's a very charismatic person. He puts a lot of effort into this. He spends millions on consultants and travel, even in off years, to go and round up those donors, to talk to them, to meet them where they are, to get money out of them. And, it really shows. So Stacey Garrity, or I would say any Republicans, are really going to have trouble because you do need money to win these races. I mean, you don't. Or I should say, money makes it a lot easier to win, you know. And Stacey Garrity, his likely GOP opponent, one of the only, like, two announced candidates, at least at this point, she has raised money in the past, but she's mostly been able to get a lot of support from Jeff Yass, or PACs linked to him. He's Pennsylvania's wealthiest man. He made his money off of stock trading for Susquehanna International Group. Groups funded by Yass have provided a lion's share of Garrity's money when she's run won up an upset in 2020 and then won again in 2024 as an undercard to President Trump. So, and she's shared donors from labor unions. The unions backed her in 2024. So, like, I wrote a story last year that was pointing out that, like, for a lot of donors who've maybe given Garrity cash in the past, they're going to probably be forced to choose. Maybe they kick a little bit to Garrity, but, you know, the person who's the governor, you don't challenge them lightly.
It's only the first week of January here as we talk, and, November 3rd's a long way away, and so I encourage you to pace yourself, stay hydrated, and you've given us a really good idea of what you'll be looking at and the landscape across the year and across the state. as you look at election news. I'm just wondering if you can give us any insight into, in the near future, what you're reporting on in the Capitol, what you'll be looking into in the coming weeks.
Yeah, so, you know, I do really like to remind myself that the point of politics is to win elections and then govern. And speaking of governing, there will be a budget address coming from Governor Shapiro at the beginning of February. That'll be his announcement of his policy priorities and, you know, what he wants to spend and how he wants to focus his efforts that the legislature then sort of responds to in months of closed-door budget talks. They have been delayed many years. I think that, you know, there's going to be these dueling motives of, do we elongate this budget and use it for political points? With November, with so much on the line, or do we just get this thing done early so we can go home, raise money, run campaigns, and try to beat them fair and square? Probably be a mix of both. We'll see. One thing the governor's office has confirmed to me is that they're going to talk about housing in that address. Otherwise, kind of a big blank book. But, you know, there's just, as you said, there's a lot of time in November, and there's still some things that need to be done, you know, in terms of governing. And those will be my focus because, you know, that's the point of this thing.
We've been talking to Stephen Caruso, a Capitol reporter for Spotlight PA. His work's up now at spotlightpa.org. And Stephen, thank you as always for breaking this down for us.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, finally tonight, we received some unsurprising news yesterday that the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has officially voted to dissolve. Now, if you even know about the CPB, you may have thought that they were already gone after last year's defunding. They were still doing some work since then, shoring things up as best they could. And I think some folks thought that they might hold on as an organization and wait for a change of leadership in Washington. Well, they sent a statement yesterday explaining why that's not happening. And it was addressed to managers of public radio and television stations, but the news is so significant, the issues they raise are so important, and the support that listeners like you have shown us has been so amazing that the staff and I here at Radio Catskill think that it's important to share this with you. Here's what they sent us. Two public media station general managers and system leaders from Ruby Calvert, Chair, CPB Board of Directors, Patricia Harrison, President and CEO. Subject, dissolution of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It has been our great honor to serve as a CEO and as a board chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. From our perspectives, we have witnessed firsthand the important role public media plays locally and nationally in keeping our democracy strong. The Public Broadcasting Act created CPB as an independent entity to steward the federal government's investment in public broadcasting. This mission included achieving universal service in public media, the ability for all Americans, whether in rural communities or major cities, to access non-commercial, high-quality content and telecommunications services. CPB also supported public media programs and services that informed, educated, and enriched the public with a focus on content that addressed the needs of underserved audiences, especially children and minorities. CPB also invested in digital platforms and the distribution infrastructure that delivered public media and content and emergency alerts to local stations, ensuring that communities everywhere could rely on public media both in daily life and in moments of crisis. For decades, you have been the heart of public media. You have given voice to local stories that would otherwise go untold. You've provided children with educational programming that transforms lives. You have built trust through rigorous fact-based journalism. You've connected neighbors to one another and strengthened civic participation. Elections matter. The current administration entered office with a governing blueprint that continues to guide its actions, which included urging Congress to eliminate all federal appropriations for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Over the past year, CPB has faced sustained political and legal attacks from the administration, including efforts to terminate the CPB board and undermine the corporation's statutory independence, the cancellation of the Ready to Learn program, presidential executive orders attempting to direct CPB's operations, repeated interference with and freezing of the Next Generation Warning System grant program, and ultimately Congress's catastrophic decision to advance the administration's objective by rescinding $1.1 billion in already appropriated federal funding for CPB and public media through the Rescissions Act of 2025. We faced a choice between remaining dormant or shutting down operations. A dormant CPP would have remained vulnerable to continued political attacks, manipulation, and potential misuse in ways that could undermine our independence, the mission and principles of the Public Broadcasting Act, and the public media system we've all worked to build. Dormancy would also have required spending resources to sustain CPB operations, funds that could instead go to the system that is reeling from the loss of federal funds. After extensive deliberation, legal counsel, and input from public media leaders, past and present, the board decided to dissolve. This decision was made to protect you, your stations, and the integrity of public media, not to preserve our jobs or CPB itself at any cost. While Congress has chosen to eliminate appropriations for CPB, the legislative foundation that recognizes the value and necessity of public broadcasting remains intact. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 itself remains the law of the land. This act established the fundamental principles and legal framework for public broadcasting in America. This means the statutory mandate for a strong, independent public broadcasting system persists, even as the mechanism for federal funding has been removed. The principles enshrined in the Act, editorial independence, localism, universal service, educational mission, and service to underserved communities, remain as vital guideposts for the future of public media. We are all well aware about the profound challenge to public media due to the loss of CPB funding and federal funding. Many of you rely on CPB grants for critical operations, infrastructure, journalism and programming, and educational initiatives. Through our funding, CPB has always sought to augment the impact of the services that you provide to your communities. As CPB has been winding down operations, we have taken every possible step to support stations during this transition. Our final grants have focused on sustaining public media programming and services as effectively as possible. As one of our last grant actions, CPB will provide support to the American Archive of Public Broadcasting to continue digitizing and preserving content that documents our collective contributions to American society and culture. That work continues, and it matters now more than ever. The road forward will require resilience, innovation, and new approaches to sustaining your mission. We know that you and your teams have always risen to meet challenges, and we have confidence in your leadership. The public media system will endure because of your dedication and the unwavering support of your communities. While CPB's chapter is ending, the mission we have shared must live through your continued service. We are profoundly grateful for your partnership over the years. You've inspired us with your commitment to serving communities that too often go underserved. Your integrity and resilience have made public media one of the most trusted institutions in American life. Thank you for everything you do to serve your communities. With deep respect and gratitude, Patricia Harrison, President and CEO, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Ruby Calvert, Chair of the Board, Corporation for Public Broadcasting. End quote from their letter sent to us yesterday. I wanted to read all of that to you, not to be sad, not to be scared, and not because this is marking the end of an era. What I love about the statement that we just read, it's so clearly explaining the new era that we've already been in for months now. The CPB has actively decided not to wait around and continue to be a political punching bag because, as they so beautifully laid out there, although the nature of public radio has changed, although the funding of public radio has gone away, after more than a half century of dedicated, reliable, and accurate informational services to the American public, the mission of public radio remains. And I wanted to share that with you because all of the encouragement in it that's directed at station staff, it might as well be directed at you, because you're part of the team too. You're part of this mission. And your support during this maddening moment in American history has meant so, so much to all of us here on air and behind the scenes at Radio Catskill. And we all just want to thank you again so much for standing with us. And that is definitely going to do it for the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you for being here with me and for a lot of my talking. Join me again tomorrow evening at 6. We'll do it again. Maybe less talking for me this time. Coming up at 7, stay with us. We got 2 hours of phenomenal music from Mr. Kusar Grace on Music Emporium. But before that, we've got more news from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
Every weekday morning at 9, NewsHour from the BBC brings you the most important international news stories. NewsHour helps you understand a complex world. Stay informed with NewsHour from the BBC, weekday mornings at 9 on Radio Catskill.